Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. An email from the liberal group MoveOn.org went out this weekend referring to the sixth stage of grief. You know, the usual five, right? And they end with acceptance. Acceptance, in this case, of the election of Donald Trump. But MoveOn says there should be a sixth stage of grief, and it's organizing. Which brings us to our next guest. Jane McAlevey is a longtime organizer in the environmental and labor movements and postdoctoral fellow in the labor and work-life program at the Harvard Law School. Her new book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, maps out a blueprint for successful social change movements in a political landscape dominated by conservative think tanks and corporate interests. Welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
What do you think about that idea, as organizing as the sixth stage of grief?
I think if we did actually more organizing, the way I hope that MoveOn means it and the way I'm going to describe, we could avert getting actually to the losses that we just had. And I think that's part of what I want. That's part of what my new book is trying to talk about is actually how do we do it? Partly how do we get here and how do we get out of it? So I am in complete agreement with the sixth stage theory there. And part of what I think has happened in the last sort of 45 years, and this is what I outline in the book, is that unfortunately, whether it's the Democratic Party or the coalition that makes up the Democratic Party, women, trade unions historically has a very key component to it, we reached this moment in the early 1970s in America where we had made huge change in the civil rights movement. We made huge change in the conditions of work. No longer were little girls going off to factories in New York City and burning up in the Triangle, whatever it was, right? So, and it was sort of like we misunderstood how power works in our society and how democracy works. And after 40 years of great gains, Social Security, Medicare, all these things came in, the Voting Rights Act, the Clean Water Act, it was sort of like the entire progressive side of the aisle shifted strategy fundamentally to moving to nice offices in Washington, D.C., hiring lobbyists, hiring lawyers, and thinking all we had to do was implement our new laws. And it was a fundamental misunderstanding that the second we did that, the corporate right, 1973, there was actually a meeting that Karl Rove, a young Dick Cheney, and a bunch of guys in 1973 sat down and had a meeting and said, it's going to take us 40 to 45 years to undo everything they just did. And I'm looking at my watch because it's about 45 years. They have patience. They had a plan. They did a social structural analysis. And the first thing that they knew they had to do was, well, two things. One, they had to take out America's trade unions. This was an early 1973 strategy. We have to get rid of the only institution that has ever actually been a counterweight to corporate capital in this country, which was actually trade unions. So that was one. And they've done a pretty good job at it, pretty thoroughgoing. And the second thing they said was, we actually have to organize a grassroots base. So Phyllis Schlafly comes up in the context of the Equal Rights Amendment, right? She died recently. But Phyllis Schlafly begins the sort of homemakers fight back at a grassroots level. The National Rifle Association, the Christian Coalition. So my argument in this book is that essentially we swapped strategies. The progressive movement made a huge mistake. We stopped actually engaging face-to-face with ordinary Americans. We thought we had made the change we needed to make, and we just had to implement it. That's not how democracy works. And so part of what I argue is in the new book, it's all set in the new millennium. I take cases where people like me, I'm going to talk about Nevada in a minute with you, but I helped tens of thousands of workers actually form unions just since the year 2000. And every place that we're actually still growing the labor base, the states are still blue and we're actually still winning.
Now, this became a big topic of dispute, I think is the right word, within the labor movement, right, where the AFL-CIO splintered because Andy Stern and the service employees unions decided that there wasn't enough organizing. There was just too much collecting money and putting money into Democratic Party candidates. And the private sector, union representation especially, was dying on the vine. And so Andy Stern and the SEIU splintered. What was their faction? Change Now?
Change to Win.
Change to Win. And they said organize, organize, organize. But that's a while ago now. Did it work?
So here's a great example of where it did work. First of all, the book goes into great detail about how even though they said organize, 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 they actually meant mobilize, mobilize, mobilize. And what I outline in the book is the difference between advocacy, mobilizing, and organizing. And mobilizing, I'm arguing, is actually what Stern's people did, which relied on pollsters. There's been this huge, ridiculous over-reliance on pollsters. I want to talk about what pollsters did wrong. They didn't just get the election wrong. Their insertion in our progressive movement in the last 25 to 30 years, it's a new thing. As a young organizer, I say in the book, I didn't know from pollsters when I was young at this work. And then by about 10 years later, the pollsters have replaced the organizers as the chief strategists in the movement. But guess what pollsters don't do? They don't actually help people change their mind about something. They're just sitting on the phone. So the example of where it did work is so profoundly important. I'm about to publish an article on this. What happened in Nevada versus Wisconsin, right, in this election? The progressives won in Nevada. You look at the maps in the New York Times and every beautiful map, the only place where really great progress happened was in the state of Nevada. I had the pleasure of helping to rebuild a very robust union in the state of Nevada between 2004 and 2008. And so literally the only place in the country where both state legislative branches flipped blue and not red, everywhere else the trend line is they flipped red. Scott Walker destroys the unions in Wisconsin. Mitch Snyder goes after them in Michigan. And both those states flip the wrong way, where people are confused, they vote for Trump. In Nevada, where three unions, really, the Carpenters Union, very progressive leadership there, myself at SEIU at the time, and the Culinary Workers Union, the Casino Workers Union, we go in and it's a right-to-work state. This is such an important lesson because that's where we're going in about 3 months in this country. They flip, that whole state's right-to-work. I get sent in there, actually, as a test of can we build unions in a right-to-work state. We built a union to 80-person membership. We organized seven hospitals back-to-back in a right-to-work state between 2004 and 2008. It didn't take long. And now the result is because we did real organizing, face-to-face base building, the only place that we won was Nevada.
Because the organized unions turned out the vote?
Absolutely. I don't think anyone in Nevada, in a real analysis of how did we just do in Nevada what no one did in the rest of the country, it's because it's the one state where in the private sector we went in and we busted our butt and we had thousands of face-to-face conversations and two coalitions came in to help drive that vote out and the unions in Nevada just did the complete opposite of what happened in Wisconsin and Michigan.
You called Nevada a right-to-work state. Explain right-to-work, and I know it's been a Trump platform. It's always a Republican talking point in elections. What is it that they would enact? And people don't know the term. When you say right to work, it sounds like it's something from the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, not only that, but the extreme right and the Republican strategists are always really good at what they call things, right? Like three strikes, you're out. It sounds like a baseball game. It means they just jailed all the black people in California under that law. Right. So what is right to work? For one thing, we say it's right to work for less. That's what we actually, in the labor movement, we say right to work means right to work for less. What it means is that even if workers vote by supermajority to join the union, they don't have to pay dues. And that's the fundamental difference between a state like New York, where that is not the law, and it's not going to be the law anytime soon, by the way, unless they do it by constitutional feat and a Supreme Court, which they may be able to do. They can't do that in the short term, though, not in a state like New York or California. So in Nevada, even if we win a majority of workers, a supermajority in a big election, the workers never, ever have to join the union. So what it means is we have to build a relationship with our rank-and-file members that is deep enough and profound enough and real enough that the members understand that they actually really want to be part of their organization. Now, this is not an argument for it, which some people say, well, shouldn't it all be that way, Jane, because then you're going to have to be obligated to build it. The truth is it's coming from a right-wing attack, just like do we want to undo TPP or trade deals from a right-wing attack? Not really. I'm kind of happy the trade deal is going to go away. But the key thing is people think we can't win in right-to-work states. And my argument coming out of Nevada, and it's been bore out in this election in beautiful ways, is that when we rebuild real union bases, we actually flip states back to blue. And what's weird to me is that the Democratic Party, I argue in the book, has made a huge, huge, huge strategic shift. They believed that demography was destiny, that big data was strategy, and that pollsters could replace organizers. And that combination of things led them to think, we don't care if the unions go away. So for 35 years, the Democrats have been letting the union base wither.
We're going to run out of time in a minute, but you use a New York example in your book as a positive example for the future, and that's Make the Road, which is not a union.
Yeah, it's not a union. In fact, what I say is, though, they come in their strategic endeavor. What they do is they put a big priority on face-to-face organizing. And in 2000, when I looked at their work, it was really interesting because I've done both community organizing, environmental organizing, and, of course, union organizing and union negotiating. And the key, what I look at the book is Make the Road does the same thing that winning unions do. They prioritize face-to-face grassroots organizing, what I call real base building, and they actually are expanding the base of people from whom we can mobilize for an election. That's the difference, and we've got to get back to really basic face-to-face organizing.
And we are going to leave it there with Jane McAlevey and a vision for the future, considering where the union movement is now and where, by extension, the Democratic Party is now, as you heard her tie the two together with respect to these election results. Her new book is called No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In a minute, we'll talk about what happened at Hamilton on Friday night.